Welcome into You're the Cure, Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Of course, along the way, if you have any questions for the good doctor, feel free to join in on the program. You can certainly do so via text 806-745-5800 or call in 745-5800. Of course, Veritas, the number at our clinic, 8556-VERITAS. That's the number to call. And let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD.
Good morning, Wade.
Good morning, sir. Health coach Melody Wilkes.
Good morning.
With us on the show. I don't know who that is, by the way. Never met her. Never seen her before in my entire life. Oh, well, here we go.
I want to know what Dr. Edwards is reading over there.
Studying up for today's program. We're just going, we're going to just have a good one-on-one session. So he's got the book opened. What are you going to talk about today, Doc?
Well, I was kind of thinking back over all our shows the past many months since I've started interviewing these experts in various topics. And there's been a common theme throughout all of it, and that's unintended consequences.
Oh, yes.
And we talked about it a little bit last week with that sunscreen, Dr. Plourd.
That was a wild interview, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's interesting. Lots of good information.
Whoa.
For sure. But one of the things in her book it talks about, and she kind of touched on it, that we put these chemicals in the original sunscreens to block UVB. B is the ones that burn you. So people didn't get burned. They could stay in the sun instead of 30 minutes and have to get out because they're burning. They could stay in it for 3 hours or 4 or 5 hours because of the sunscreens. But that whole time, they're being exposed to the near-infrared, which penetrates deeper into the body and does more DNA damage. So we just exposed ourselves to a whole lot more damage than, you know, just the sunburn.
Mm.
So the unintended consequence of blocking the burn is we got more skin cancer because melanoma rates, as she explained, have increased ever since sunscreen was introduced. Part of that because you block your vitamin D production. Vitamin D is very beneficial for the immune system and anti-cancer effects. So it just kind of made me think about all the guests we've talked to, and almost every single one of them, whether it was Joel Salatan, who he's a farmer, and he teaches other farmers how to make a living on 100 acres, and he doesn't till the land, and he does high-density stock rates, so he'll put 100 cows on 5 acres or something like that. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's something very, very high-density stock rates, but he moves them every 12 to 24 hours. Causes the soil to be nourished greatly because the cow's hooves are kind of plowing the field and pooping and peeing and fertilizing and aerating the soil. But the growth of the grass, you know, increases tremendously. And the unintended consequence of putting 4 cows on a section of land like we do around here, or 20 cows on a section, is they just eat the most tasty grass until it's dead. And you lose species, you lose diversification, which is Joel Salatin's whole point. So just so many different unintended consequences. The raw milk guy we had on, the Abernathy Dairy, Prairie Pastures, you know, talking about the genetics, they bred the dairy cows to produce something like 300 pounds of milk instead of the traditional dairy cow that farmers had, I think, made like 30 or 40 pounds of milk.
Now they got that food truck running around. Have you seen that?
Yeah, they do. I haven't gotten to eat
yeah,
out of
I haven't
it,
either.
I've heard it's great. Actually, here it is, 12 pounds. That's what I was looking up. 12 pounds of milk to 39 pounds of milk today. But the genetics that they had to do to get it to that 39 pounds of milk, it altered it produced certain proteins in the milk that are more pro-inflammatory. People react to it. Albert talked about his wife being lactose intolerant, basically couldn't tolerate dairy unless they had these ancient genetics. Cows with the ancient genetics, A2, he called it. And she could literally take, you know, they'd milk a cow, hand her the glass of milk, and she'd drink it and either would have an immediate reaction, so they knew it wasn't the ancient genetics.
Bless her heart, she was committed.
Yeah.
Doing that.
But
wow, yeah.
Obviously, the purpose of those genetics was to get more milk production, to produce more milk, to feed the world, and to make a profit and all that. But those more pro-inflammatory proteins that were produced have caused a lot of us to be intolerant to milk. And same with homogenization, pasteurization, these different processing techniques to allowed to have longer shelf life, but I think he also talked about when you homogenize, that's breaking the good, healthy fat. I mean, raw milk is one of the healthiest fats you could drink. And when you homogenize it, it's kind of like forcing it through this tiny screen that breaks the fat up into small fat particles that are pro-inflammatory. They're oxidized LDL, which we've talked about before. Cholesterol is not bad and fat's not bad, but when it's inflamed or oxidized, that is a problem. And there is a blood test you can measure your oxidized LDL. Nobody does that, but we should, because that's what really matters if your LDL is inflamed and oxidized. So that's just another unintended consequence on the milk production. But then you, even talking about the wheat, you know, the hybridization of the wheat, the original wheat, the einkorn has, I think it's 12 chromosomes. Today's wheat has 42 chromosomes. Norman Borlaug, 1970, Nobel Prize, because of the big hybridization he put in place. There are many strains of wheat that have been hybridized since ancient times, but the big hybridization was in 1970. Dr. Mark Hyman, the head of the Institute of Functional Medicine at Cleveland Clinic, called that process, the hybridization that Borlaug did in 1970, created a super starch, super gluten, and a super drug. And he said that because the starch content changed during that hybridization. Amylopectin A and amylopectin B are the two different starches in the wheat. And the ratio shifted so that the starch content is such that it's the starch that will break down very rapidly. Even your amylase and your saliva will start to break the starch down in this new wheat, in the modern wheat, so rapidly that it turns it into sugar, glucose. So your blood sugar will rise within 5 seconds of you chewing on that whole wheat toast or cereal or bread or pasta or hamburger bun or whatever. And it'll raise your blood sugar as fast as a 16-ounce can of soda.
Now, why was it done again? Was it so that you could mass-produce more pounds?
Right.
More bushels?
It went from ancient wheat was 4 foot tall, and dwarf wheat, which was the hybridization, it's what was created during that hybridization process. Dwarf wheat is about 18 inches tall, and the yields went up 10 times.
So it was a bushel. Per bushel situation.
Exactly.
Because we got to feed the world, so we're going to manipulate the genes, the genetic code,
right,
so we can feed more people.
Right. Also drought resistant, wind resistant, so all the good things that a farmer would want. If the goal was mass production, I mean, that was the goal, that's what you got. But the unintended consequence was the starch content changed, so it elevates blood sugar rapidly, and we've had an obesity epidemic after we were told to eat, 8 servings of grain a day. And that was just one of the unintended consequences.
A lot. 8 servings?
It's crazy. I recommend like 2 a week if you're healthy, none if you're not, until you get healthy. But another, like Mark Hyman said, that's the super drug part of it, because it spikes your blood sugar so quickly you get addicted to it. I mean, I just talked to a gentleman this weekend that he's starting to really pay attention to what he eats and how he feels. And he's a pretty healthy guy, but he said he can't even eat a sandwich anymore because of the crash he gets in the afternoon, a sandwich for lunch, because of that afternoon crash. And that's part of it's the blood sugar. When you spike your blood sugar so rapidly, insulin will kick in, and that'll drop your blood sugar rapidly. And so you get on this roller coaster of blood sugar up and down, and a big part of that is because of the grains, specifically the wheat. And then the super gluten he talked about, you know, everyone's gluten sensitive and gluten free and all this stuff that we're seeing. And most of these gluten proteins are new proteins. They're not in the ancient wheat, the einkorn flour, which I made our blueberry muffins out of this weekend. There's just a whole lot more protein, gluten protein, different types of gluten in the modern wheat. Everybody's reacting to it. And then the, he called it a super drug, super starch, and then a super gluten, and that kind of covers that. And then they desiccate it. They spray the Roundup, 80% of the wheat, not around here because I don't think it's grown for food consumption around here. It's more for a cover crop or maybe animal feed, I'm not sure. But I know in the Midwest where it's for food consumption, 80% of it's sprayed with glyphosate right before harvest. So the seed is soaked, and Stephanie Seneff talked about this. when the wheat is doused in the glyphosate and the seed takes it internally, even can't be washed off. And they did that because you get an increased yield. You get 10% more yield when you stress the plant right at the end, and you can kill the plant so you can plant your next crop quickly. The soil is ready for the next crop. But then there's a whole host of unintended consequences of glyphosate we could spend 30 minutes talking about, and we have on numerous shows talked about that.
So text coming in, and back to the raw milk deal. So your opinion on raw milk is what again? And what do you think about the less than 20 net carb a day plan for weight loss?
My opinion on raw milk is it's exceedingly beneficial and healthy. I mean,
I noticed when I drank a lot of it, because we were doing that for a while. You got to be careful. You'll gain weight fast. Yeah. I mean, it's just like I'm like a big calf, you know? I mean,
but he would drink a huge glass.
I would drink like 8 ounces at a time. It tastes so good, though.
Yeah, well, that's what I tell everybody pretty much with everything, not just raw milk. Don't go crazy on it. Moderation.
Good, more is better.
Don't let any food control you. Don't get addicted to any food, even if it's the good stuff.
I mean, we drive out there and go get
kale.
The raw milk.
You could get addicted to kale. I'd probably be okay.
Oh, you will, yeah. Addicted to kale.
Yeah, the vegetables,
yuck.
I'd probably put an asterisk there. You can eat all you want of that.
So,
but as far as all the minerals, vitamins, amino acids, fats, I mean, you could live off raw milk only. It would sustain a human body.
That's crazy.
It grows a calf from a 100-pound calf.
So I could do that and just intermittent fast, and voila.
There you go.
Yeah, there's been people that have done it.
I wouldn't have to think of what to cook or anything.
I mean, the bacteria are in it, the good beneficial bacteria are in it, the enzymes are in it to break all the proteins down, and the sugars down so you don't react to it
as much.
So
how much could you drink a day and not, half a cup?
If that's all you were doing.
That's it?
I mean, everyone's biochemistry and gut flora is different, so I don't think I'd set a rule that, everybody could drink, 3 glasses a day or something. Some people can. I mean, a lot of those raw milk dairymen, that's what they do. There's a guy, I was watching an interview, I forget his name, he's in California, and that's his main part of his diet, raw milk. But, for most of my patients who are inflamed, standard American, they've got insulin resistance, they're dealing with a lot of metabolic issues, I even tell them no milk for 30 days at least, and sometimes longer. And then once their gut's healthy and their flora is reestablished and their insulin spike and roller coaster has been diminished or non-existent, I think of 8 to 16 ounces maybe a day, but I don't do that.
I was doing that and I was gaining weight.
I'll drink 8 ounces maybe a week, and a lot of that's recipes and stuff like that. So I do it in moderation, but everyone's different. I mean, depend on your
goals, I guess.
Your goals depend on your mainly your gut flora. I mean, the diversity of gut flora.
Does it help with that though? I mean, big time, right?
Yeah, especially if you ferment it, get kefir, or do the yogurt with raw milk. Make yogurt, I mean, you get tremendous amount of bacteria, beneficial bacteria.
It'd be so much better for kids to drink that than.
Yeah, we got some kefir the other day from the dairy in Abernethy, and my kids love it. We put it on frozen berries, and they
really?
Ask for it. I mean, it's just tastes a little sour, kind of like sour cream. But when someone's really trying to reestablish gut flora, say after antibiotics, I mean, you can take a probiotic pill, a capsule. And that's okay, but much, much better to do a fermented food, especially if you can get a local fermented food, so the local bacteria from our environment in this region of West Texas.
Kind of like the same thing with honey, right?
Yeah.
You want to get honey from beekeepers from this area to combat allergies.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it has the different allergens, the different proteins, and pollens, and whatnot from this area that you might be reacting to. So fermented food, awesome. Like Bubby's sauerkraut, I mean, that's really good. It's in the refrigerated section at the grocery store.
I eat that sometimes.
Where it's not pasteurized sauerkraut, which is on the shelf. You got to go to the refrigerated section. And that's really excellent, but it's not made here in West Texas, meaning the bacteria that's fermented in it aren't local, and that's okay. I mean, definitely it's better than any other sauerkraut. But when you can ferment it yourself in your own home, or a local person's fermenting that for you, I mean, that's awesome. for the gut flora. And then
the second part was carbs. Yeah, this is the 20 net carb plan a day for those that are, you know, again, have all kinds of health issues going on. They're type 2 diabetic. They're on their last rope, you know. Yep. Blah, blah, blah.
I love the low carb, and 20 is really, really low.
And that's Dr. Anderson. You know, I talked to him on Tuesday.
Because carbs are in almost everything.
I don't even know if I could. I keep telling the guy, you know, he's on Tuesdays. I tell him all the time, I don't know if I could do it. I just don't.
You can. You can do it.
Oh, wow.
It's a mind thing.
For a time period.
It's a mind thing.
That's crazy.
But here's my take, and we've talked about it before. The main problem is the standard American's getting like 300 carbs.
Yeah, and that's too much, right?
We're getting so many carbs, we don't even realize it, from our goldfish snacks, our peanut butter crackers, our spaghetti, and our buns, and our breads, and our cereals. And, I mean, it's carboholic. I mean, we're a carb nation. And part of that started in the 1950s, which we can talk about this too, unintended consequences, when that recommendation came out to go low fat. That the whole theory that eating fat, saturated fat in particular, will cause heart attack and stroke, cause heart disease. You know, that came out in the 50s. Everyone got off bacon and eggs, went to cereal. And from that point on, this low fat craze, people replace it with carbs.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the obesity epidemic started, diabetes epidemic, and really almost every Western disease, because all Western disease is rooted in inflammation. So heart attacks and strokes have gone up, cancer's gone up, Alzheimer's, I mean, you name it.
And we're talking healthcare all morning long prior to your show about the Republican plan to fix healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not even addressing this kind of stuff, or talking about wellness, or talking about what are the root causes to our health care crisis in this country.
Yep.
And I made mention of it in the first hour of the show this morning at 7:30 this morning. And that's a real big problem, because we're just now starting to finally educate a certain segment of society that really, when it comes to health care, education is key. But it's up to you, ultimately, if you're going to be a healthy person or a person that's a train wreck.
Yeah, because there's everyone's got ulterior motives, mainly profit, mainly money. You know, Ansel Keys is the one who put a study out in the 1950s. He was commissioned by the Grain Producers of America, though. So he went and studied literature from around the world on heart attacks, and correlated certain countries had more heart attacks, they ate more fat. And then he published like this 7 or 8 country study. And it showed this correlation between dietary fat and heart attack. But what no one knew until many, many years later, when we started digging deeper, was there were 8 other or 10 other countries out there. I think there were 22 countries total that he looked at. And he cherry-picked the 8 that showed higher dietary saturated fat intake, more heart attack. Well, there were 8 or 10 countries with the exact opposite, high saturated fat and low heart attack rate. But he just threw those out, which obviously that makes it invalid. You can't base any decision off of that, but a decision was based off of that. Eat low fat, go eat more grain. And the point is, there was some motivation behind that in the grain producer lobby to get a they want to get into that breakfast market, get off the bacon and eggs, get the cereal going. And I'm fast forwarding now till just last week when the American Heart Association came out and said, it's almost laughable how polar opposite this is. They said basically eat more vegetable oils and don't eat coconut oil. Polar opposite.
I saw that.
Polar opposite of what we preach and every integrative functional medicine physician preaches. And I would contend polar opposite of what the research shows. And I kept digging through their statement. And this was an advisory board statement. So this is a committee of the American Heart Association, and they just put out this statement. I kept looking for, well, where's the study? So I could really read it and critique it, because every study's critiquable. Every study, there's biases. There's, you know, you got to really look at
where
the
funding is coming from. I mean, it's like global warming. Okay, if 97% of climatologists think that man-made global warming is real, then you say, well, okay, where are those 97% getting their funding from?
Exactly.
The federal government, who want to shape that opinion. That's the reality of this stuff.
You always have to look at the funding. You have to look at reproducibility. So many studies can't be reproduced. There's all kinds of flaws in these studies. But anyways, I couldn't even find the study on the American Heart Association's recommendation. So the more I dug, the more it seemed to be it's just this common notion since the 1950s, 1960s. That's what they're basing it off of, that saturated fat's bad. And what I just talked about, Ansel Keys is the primary one who got that. I mean, he was on the cover of Time magazine. He was the one that started really getting this whole thought out there into the public that saturated fat's not good for you. And it continues. It persists to this day despite tons of evidence to the contrary. So I had a lot of calls at the clinic last week for my statement on that. I'm in the process of writing up my official statement so I can put it out there for all of our members to read. But everybody's already, Gary Taubes, we should have him on here. He's the one that wrote the book, Why We Get Fat. And it's all about eating the carbs instead of eating healthy fat.
Speaking of the fat, back to the text line, it says, if not 20 net carbs, where do you set the line? I guess depending on what you're wanting to do.
I don't set a line. I'm so anti, give me a rule and I'm going to follow it. That's what Americans want. That's what our system of healthcare has been dictated on. The patient come in with a complaint, the doctor give you the answer with a prescription pad, and the patient doesn't have to think about anything after that as far as what's my pattern, what makes me feel good, what makes me feel bad, listening to their body. So I don't set a rule. I don't have anyone measure their carbs. If they want to, fine. If that's their personality, they need to measure 20 grams, 40 grams, whatever. That's fine. But I don't preach that rule necessarily. I preach I'll just cut people off completely, basically, off grains and sugars. Now, there's other carbs besides grains and sugars, but that's such a huge part of the American diet, and so much of it's a habit, so much of it's an addiction. Corn, wheat, and rice, and sugar. Cut them off of it. Typically, that's enough of a low-carb diet to get the job done. Now, when people come back in 2 or 3 months for a follow-up, if they're still inflamed, they didn't lose but 2 pounds, okay, now you're going to do a food diary, and I'm going to actually see what did you actually eat every day, and did you get, you know, some too many carbs in from a different direction, and that's when we'll start to narrow it down a little more and try to limit them in their portion size or even just the number of servings a day. Most people don't require that. If someone's still that inflamed, we'll start intermittent fasting, and we will push them more to ketogenic, which is a high fat, moderate protein, low carb. And there's when we start to talk more about those carb restrictions where you might measure. But most people, I don't want to put them on a rule like that because it's too hard. It restricts them so much. They can't stick with it. There's a lot of psychology involved. And some people, it works great. I mean, I've got office people in my office that are employees that they do super when they're measuring with their kitchen scale or they're doing on their app. They've got the app out and they can.
That's a lot of effort to do that. And if you're somebody who's got a busy family, it's like.
It's a lot of effort. So I'm trying to get people just to figure out how to do, just eat real food. High fat, moderate protein, low carb in general without having to weigh everything. Now, but again, if someone's resistant, they've come back for follow-up, they're still inflamed, they're not losing weight, or they're battling major, major health issues, cancer, autoimmune, you know, out of control diabetes.
Crohn's disease,
yeah,
whatever.
Then that's when we really do go harder with intermittent fasting, ketogenic, more of that 20 to 40 gram. But long term, I don't have people weighing stuff or measuring stuff like that. I want them to kind of more intuitively know, you know, that amount of carb right there, that's a little much. Or I just had a fair amount of a serving of carb at lunch, skipping it for breakfast or supper and breakfast maybe. And they just get to learn that there's this pattern to it. And I want them
that's more carb cycling you're talking about.
Right. But I want them to correlate when they feel good. You know, when I ate this way, I felt good. My school mm-hmm. pattern was good. My mm-hmm. sleep pattern was good. My mm-hmm. energy pattern was good. My brain fog was good. Mm-hmm. All of it. Or if weight's their main issue, you know, when will they lose more weight? When will they not?
That's been the only thing that's made me lose weight, is that intermittent fasting and the low carb, because I tried for years and years and years and years, and I thought I was eating good and exercising.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing, I'm with Dr. Fung, it's that insulin spike, which is what you get when you eat carb. You will spike insulin, and insulin tells you to store fat. That's your number one fat storage hormone. That's what Gary Taubes' whole book is about, why we get fat. It's a hormone issue, and the main hormone's insulin. You do not get fat from eating fat. You get fat from eating carbs that spike insulin, because insulin tells your body to store fat. You don't get fat by putting more calories in than what you burned out. That whole theory's been debunked. Gary Taubes, again, his book describes that whole thing, why that doesn't work.
The protein can cause an insulin spike.
It can, because it can change into glucose. Your body can convert protein to glucose. So that's why it's a moderate protein, not a high protein, moderate protein. High fat, moderate protein, low carb. But insulin resistance, I mean, insulin's why we get fat. Insulin resistance means the body's not responding to or listening to or being affected by the insulin spike, so the body puts out more insulin. It's kind of like a kid, you know, that's disobeying you, and you kind of holler at him to cut it out, and he doesn't listen, so then you holler a little louder, then you holler a little louder. Now you're screaming at the top of your lungs. That's the same thing with insulin. You put a little bit of insulin out to try to lower your blood sugar, but you've eaten so many carbs and your sugar's so high, you got to put more insulin out and more insulin out and more and more and more. But over time, the body doesn't listen to it anymore. The receptors on the cell membrane get blunted, get kind of bent out of shape by inflammation. And so the key doesn't fit the keyhole. The hormone doesn't fit the hormone receptor anymore. And so you're producing tons of insulin because you're having to scream at the top of your lungs for your body to try to respond to that. And so you're just storing a ton of fat. So the way to reverse that whole process, reverse the amount of screaming you have to do and reverse the resistance to that, the keyhole for it to be cleaned up, is fasting. Plain and simple. Just don't put food in your mouth, so therefore you don't spike insulin. Your insulin goes to close to zero, and the insulin receptor will clean right up, and the weight will come off. So it's a great technique to use, and it's not rocket science. Cultures have been intermittent fasting for ages, not because they knew what it was doing to their insulin receptors, but just out of necessity. That's just how life was when food wasn't available 24/7 at every corner store. We had to fast because there wasn't any food to eat. It was kind of this feast and famine thing. And back to the grain, same with the grain. Before we had all these modern agricultural techniques, to grow a grain up, especially that ancient grain that was 4 foot tall and the wind would blow and knock it over and it wasn't drought resistant, it was tough to grow the crop. And then to harvest that thing by hand, and then to process it, grind that thing down, have your cows, or, you know, that
stone mill.
The stone mill thing. Mm-hmm. It was a ton of effort just to get a cup of flour. I don't know the exact conversion of how many acres of einkorn, ancient grain, to get one cup of flour.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a process. It wasn't something where you could just have tons of grain all the time. And in that ancient way of harvesting, the kernels would mature to a point that there were more enzymatic processes going on. More enzymes were being fully matured in the kernel, and the enzymes would help break parts of that starch down, parts of the protein down, the gluten down, so that when you actually consume it, number one, you're getting the whole kernel, you're getting the oil, you're getting the germ, all of it, but all the enzymes to help break some of that down. So totally different process, and you could only consume a little bit at a time because there just wasn't that much. So but anyways, that's kind of a tangent. Back to the carb thing, Americans get way too much, so yeah, you've got to limit it. And some people, you put a rule on them, but most people, I just tell them, skip some meals, go high fat, moderate protein, low carb. We'll give them some examples of what that looks like. We'll give them some recipes to stick with, or recommend a couple websites to look at that are ketogenic recipes, and tell them to eat like that. If they are the personality type that needs to measure, needs to have the app, and needs to get real strict like that, fine. We can do that. It's just most patients don't need that.
All right. We'll take a quick break right here. We'll come right back. Stick around. We got plenty to go right here on You're the Cure. Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. not only for great information, but also past shows. You can check it out there on the website, veritasmedical.com. All right, right back at it. All right, so we've been talking about all things health and how we can achieve optimum health by what you put into your mouth.
Or not put into your mouth, right?
That's all good.
Well, and I just want to run down, I just off the top of my head this morning, I was trying to think of the different unintended consequences, and I'm just going to read them off. We can talk about more in-depth any that you want to, but salt, that's the other book I have over here, Salt Your Way to Health. And what made me think of this, for Father's Day, I got my dad a, or actually my wife Jamie found it, but we got it for my dad. It's a Himalayan salt block. Like a big block of salt that you cook on. And there's a recipe book that came with
it.
And I don't know a lot about it. We just saw it online and thought, that's cool. And we sent it to him. But then it clicked with me. He's still conventional-minded as far as his doctor. He goes to a doctor for high cholesterol and blood pressure.
Your old dad.
Yeah, my dad.
And
it clicked with me. I thought, oh, no, Dad's doctor's probably told him for his hypertension to go low salt or no salt. So I had to call him on Father's Day and say, hey, that present that you're opening.
Can I have it back?
It's a big old salt block. But let me tell you about that. The salt you don't want to eat is, and I agree, you should not eat man-made, iodized, processed table salt. That's a nutrient deficient additive that we don't need. Now, real salt, the salt that God made, Celtic sea salt, Himalayan sea salt, or just there's one called real salt from Utah, it has all the minerals, like 72 or 80 different trace minerals, macro, micro, all the minerals the body needs in the right ratios, and it's very beneficial to the health. Dr. Brownstein wrote the book, and hopefully we'll have him on the show soon. But the book's name is Salt Your Way to Health. And it explains all this, and I highly recommend it. But when man got in there, processed it, pulled all these minerals out so they could resell those minerals to industry as individual minerals, all they left was the sodium, the chloride, and they threw in some iodine, but it's not near enough for what we need. And so we're all mineral deficient, partly because of that. So a lot of my mentors recommend a teaspoon a day minimum of real salt or Celtic sea salt. Here's another one. Treating cholesterol with statins. When we thought cholesterol caused heart attacks and LDL's bad, then let's lower LDL. And there's no argument statins lower LDL. But as Dr. Jack Wolfson, the paleo cardiologist a few weeks ago, explained, does lowering LDL lower your heart attacks, stroke, death, mortality? Yeah, it does in high-risk patients, and it does it by about a 1 to 2%. So from 7% down to 6 or 5% only. Very, very minimal. And that's only in your high-risk population, which he defined as men who smoke, who continue to smoke, and they've had a heart attack already. There's a certain category of people that it will lower your heart attack rate by 1%. Well, based off all the advertising and everything the doctors are telling you, your conventional doctors, you would think everyone needs to be on this, and it's going to drop your heart attack rates 50%. Well, that's data manipulation. Absolute risk versus relative risk we've talked about before, but the unintended consequence of lowering cholesterol with a statin drug, cholesterol is needed to make all the hormones, including vitamin D, including a lot of the sex hormones. So all those hormones play a role in the body. The statins block a pathway that makes CoQ10. CoQ10 is an enzyme that's needed throughout the body to make your energy. Statins block a pathway called the mevalonic pathway. That is your DNA synthesis pathway. So you can't make DNA the right way. So we get increased dementia, increased type 2 diabetes, especially in women, increased hardening of the arteries, atherosclerosis, increased congestive heart failure, and increased myalgias or muscle aches. Those are five huge unintended consequences of lowering LDL with a statin. And again, the problem, like I mentioned earlier, it's inflamed cholesterol that's the issue. And that appears to be the benefit, that little tiny 1% benefit of a statin on high-risk individuals. It's the anti-inflammatory effect that actually has that benefit. And there's lots of different ways, better ways, I would say, to reduce inflammation than a statin. But chlorine in the water, that's another one. We put chlorine in there to kill bugs. Well, so we consume it, we drink it, we breathe it in. It's in our showers. It soaks through our skin. It goes through our lungs when we breathe the steam. Blocks the thyroid. It impedes normal thyroid function because it's a halogen like iodine. But when you're not consuming enough iodine in your food anymore, then chlorine gets in there and binds up your iodine receptor, and it causes dysfunction of the thyroid. That's one of the things it does.
Did
it also
you say well water would or wouldn't have high amounts of chlorine?
No. Well, and the chlorine is not normally found in the earth, in the ground, in high concentrations in well water. So that's the beauty of well water is no chlorine. But city water, you get chlorine. Now, well water has its other things, especially around here, you know, the different pesticides and stuff. And there's some naturally occurring. There's different pockets around here where there's more uranium, more arsenic. So if you're on well water, you definitely need to test it. But the point of that chlorine to kill bugs, but the unintended consequence is it's killing all the good bugs in our gut. And that's one of those unintended consequences of the Roundup, the glyphosate they spray on the wheat. It's an antibiotic. It was patented as an antibiotic. It kills your gut flora. It chelates your minerals, so you can't even absorb minerals. Lots of unintended consequences with glyphosate. Antibiotics. I mean, the germ theory in the 1800s, germ theory versus a terrain theory, I think we've talked about. When Louis Pasteur came out and said germs are, you know, the enemy, let's kill them all. And now, you know, fast forward 100 years, it turns out that was totally wrong. It's all about the terrain. You've got to optimize your internal terrain. One of my kids asked me about the plague this weekend. And is the plague going to come back? Or how did it go away? And how did smallpox go away? And because there's no vaccine for that. And I started to explain to him germ theory versus a terrain. It's all about your terrain. You need a healthy terrain. You need stomach acid. 95% of the people, I think this was Dr. Wakefield we had on, talked about 95% of the people who contracted polio never had a symptom. It's because it's an enterovirus. It enters through the GI tract. And the GI tract, the first thing it hits is hydrochloric acid in your stomach. Hydrochloric acid kills all bugs. So if you have enough, that's part of the terrain. I'm talking about optimized terrain. We're going to have Naisha Winters on, I think, July 17th, and her whole website is Optimal Terrain Consulting. She's all about the terrain. She had stage 4 cancer, ovarian cancer, and she's a long-term survivor now by optimizing her terrain.
Do you think kids are low in the stomach acid?
Oh, definitely. No doubt about it.
So it's okay to supplement them?
I mean, we have to supplement a number of kids with stomach acid until their proton pumps become more mature. Part of that is the proton pump is a pump in, it's throughout the body, but it's a high concentration in the stomach to pump the stomach acid into the stomach. That's a very high energy pump, so it needs a lot of B vitamins. It needs thyroid, iodine, zinc. There's certain minerals and vitamins it needs, thyroid hormone. So if mom was low in these while the baby was in utero, the baby's birthed and has immature proton pumps. So that's in my opinion, and a lot of the integrative docs and functional medicine doctors recognize this, immature stomach acid pumps in these newborns and infants is part of the reason we're seeing such a food intolerance and the eczema outbreak and
what
the asthma.
Acne?
Yeah, acne. Because all that points to an imbalanced flora. When you've got, and it points to leaky gut too. When someone's sensitive to all these different foods, and so many kids now are, and eczema, I mean, anything on the skin is a manifestation of the gut. It's in a window into your gut. So when the gut's leaky, when the tight junctions are open, when you've got undigested food particles coming into the contact with the immune system, just inside your gut lining is 80% of your immune system, you're going to react to all these different foods. But if the stomach acid were there like it should have been, it would have broken those foods down, broken those proteins down to amino acids. It would have triggered the gallbladder and pancreas to squirt their enzymes appropriately, because that is the trigger, is an acidic stomach pH triggers your gallbladder and pancreas to squirt. So if you don't have enough acid, you're not getting a good breakdown of your protein, you're not getting a good squirt from your gallbladder, so your fats aren't breaking down good, you're not getting a good squirt from your pancreas, so your carbs aren't breaking down good, and you don't have the right pH balance throughout the intestine to encourage good normal bacterial growth.
And then most doctors prescribe antacids.
Yeah, that's the Band-Aid. It's a symptom relief only, and that's a whole unintended consequence right there, treating symptoms instead of digging down to the root cause. But the gut's huge. The stomach acid, the lack of stomach acid, it's a big deal. But antibiotics are a big part of that. You know, the way we treat people now, because germs do cause the immune system to turn on, and that cytokine storm causes a huge issue in the body. I mean, it can kill you. Most people don't realize it. Most germs, like the flu, influenza, strep, staph, you know, Ebola, most of these germs don't actually put out a toxin that actually kills you. It's the immune system's response reaction to the germ, the cytokine storm, we call it. When you get a massive dump of your weapons of mass destruction, your immune system does a massive dump of chemical into the body. That's what causes so many of the symptoms and the sickness and even death, sepsis and death. But the whole reason the body's having to dump so much is because of that bug was allowed to get to a point, you know, overgrow to a point of overwhelming numbers. Well, if your stomach acid was where it was needed to be, and your immune system, the parts of your immune system that are the initial responders, the first responders, if they were adequately supplied with the chemicals they need to kill these bugs right off the bat, if they could recognize the bugs and kill them. So it's this whole full body immune system approach, which again, 80% of it's in the gut, and that's why the immune system's so dysfunctional, because our gut's dysfunctional. The probiotics in the gut talk to the white blood cells in the gut, your immune system in the gut. So there's huge immune dysregulation just from poor gut health, just from consuming the wrong foods, antibiotic-rich foods that kill your flora, glyphosate that opens up the tight junctions, the chlorine that kills the flora, birth control kills the flora, Splenda kills your flora. I mean, we're just constantly consuming these things that kill our flora. So lots of unintended consequences of using antibiotics to kill bugs. Antibiotics in the meat, 80% of our antibiotics are in our meat and dairy, chicken, and we eat that every day. It kills our bugs. But another one, I don't want to get stuck on any of these unless y'all want to talk about it, but chemotherapy. I mean, I was just part of a webinar this weekend where I remember this study, but he brought it back to my attention. It was some researchers in Australia published a study. They looked at all, no, not all. They looked at breast, colon, head and neck cancers in Australia and America from 1990 till 2004. They looked at all the randomized controlled trials involving chemotherapy, and it showed less than a 5% survival benefit, meaning chemotherapy mm-hmm. helped less than 5% of the patients have a better survival outcome.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
That's
the purpose of the webinar and the explanation, it was an integrative oncologist who was giving the webinar, is because chemotherapy kills tumor cells. Well, that sounds good until you realize what actually kills you are cancer stem cells, not the tumor cells. Almost always it's the cancer stem cell that leads to your mortality, to your death. Because the metastasis is through a stem cell. Well, chemotherapy kills tumor cells, but it does not kill the stem cell. And in fact, the research shows that it makes the stem cells hardier, tougher, you know, more resistant even to your own immune system's ability to kill them. So there's an unintended consequence. Let's focus on this tumor. Let's shrink the tumor. Let's cut the tumor out. Let's irradiate the tumor, because radiation does the same thing. It enhances stem cell.
My brother-in-law had or has bladder cancer, and he did all the chemo, and then they ended up removing his bladder, and then the chemo came back. I mean, the cancer came back.
It will always come, almost always come back, because, like I just said, you're killing the tumor, but the stem cells is what it floats around the body, mm-hmm. finds a little niche to hide out in, and will pop up and grow 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road. So you've got to do some other therapies. If you're going to do chemo, do therapies along with that that kill the stem cell. It's fine to kill tumor.
So what kills stem cells then?
Well, that was the point of this webinar. There's some new drugs in the pipeline to do it. But there's some natural things that'll do it too. So that's why the integrative guys have such great success with cancer. I mean,
I was reading this morning just about broccoli killing cancer.
That's one of the things, broccoli seed extract. And apoptosis.
Is that the doom?
In particular, the sprouts or even the young broccoli is like the most potent, is what this said.
Yeah. there are a number of natural things that help stimulate apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. That's where the cell should die on its own when it's a cancer cell, and it's not, because it's there are certain genes turned on and turned off in response to dysfunctional mitochondria. Cancer is really a mitochondrial disease. I don't want to go into that now. We'll have to have one of these guys on to talk about it. But the point is that the apoptosis isn't happening. The cancer cells aren't killing themselves. It's cell suicide is what it should be, and it's not happening. So there's some of the natural products that will help help those cells to actually undergo that process. And so these integrative guys get a 70 to 80% long-term survival in their patients because they combine the things. They'll do low-dose chemo. It's called insulin potentiation therapy, where they do like a tenth of the dose of chemo at the same time they administer insulin. And we've been talking about how bad insulin is. But in this setting, what happens, because cancer cells are obligated to use glucose for fuel. They can't use fat for fuel, only glucose or sugar. Mm-hmm. And cancer cells upregulate their insulin receptors tenfold. So they bring more sugar into that cancer cell than a normal human cell would. So you give
why are you feeding them?
You give the patient insulin, like in the IV, and it'll dramatically drop their blood sugar to like 30 or 40. I mean, we're talking almost dangerous in a coma, but just for an instant. And what that does is, when the blood sugar's that low, it kind of shocks that cancer cell, because that cancer cell is dependent on sugar and a lot of it for its metabolic processes. And all of a sudden, there's no sugar around. It goes kind of into this shock state where the cell membrane of the cancer cell becomes hyperpermeable or very porous. It opens up a lot of the junctions and channels, and that allows the chemo, because then you follow that insulin with just a drop of chemo, and you'll have the effect on killing that cell. So, and you don't have such a detrimental effect on the stem cell and on your immune system, because chemo really damages the immune system.
Yeah, what wipes out your cells.
What about deprivation of oxygen too? Is it you give it oxygen or deprive it of oxygen?
Cancer cells are their metabolic process. They're using glucose for fuel in a non-oxygen state. They've turned off the pathway aerobic respiration. They've turned that off, and they're doing anaerobic respiration. So they are obligate anaerobes. They do not use oxygen. And even in the presence of oxygen, you can put hyperbaric oxygen in there, and it won't flip that metabolic process. It will slow down metastases, but it won't actually flip that metabolic switch back to using oxygen. It's very interesting. So there's benefits of using high-dose oxygen, like hyperbaric, and mm-hmm. exercise with oxygen therapy and ozone. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't actually cause that cancer cell to switch back its metabolic function. So you've got to do other things for that. So you need a multifaceted, multi-pronged approach, just like the armed services. You want to come in and, you know, hit them from the air,
land,
the
air,
ground,
sea,
and the sea, and, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. You want this multifaceted approach, and that's what these integrative guys do. We're going to have some of them on later in the summer and in the fall. I'm going to do a big push for this, because, I mean, it's just such a cool thing to watch these patients get better using these integrative approaches. But back to that.
Wasn't there a lot in Germany that this actually Germans were doing this and curing people left and right, and then when it came to America,
mega doses of vitamin C.
The American Cancer Society and stuff were saying, "Oh, now wait a minute, that's just hocus pocus.
Yeah.
It doesn't work." And then you had the drug companies who were getting filthy, stinking rich off these cancer
that's
drugs.
That's demonic.
They were like, "Oh no,
the love of money."
You're
right, Gerson.
Seriously,
you're talking about Max Gerson probably, because I've quoted him before when Ty Bollinger was on and we talked about the mm-hmm. hope for cancer and the quest for the cures and all that. Gerson was a German doctor. He had bad migraines, or his wife did. I forget one or the other. But anyways, no one could help, so he started juicing carrots and apples and doing some coffee enemas, because of coffee.
Ooh.
There's chemicals in coffee when they go in rectally, stimulates a nerve. There's a nerve that goes straight from your rectum to the liver. And what it does, those chemicals trigger the liver to dump all the toxins in the bile, dump it to your colon. And this was actually a medical therapy that was in the Merck Manual, the Bible for doctors, up until like the mid-1970s. Coffee enemas were a routine standard of care kind of thing. Now people look at you like you're crazy.
Who discovered that?
I don't know. Probably Hippocrates, I imagine. But Gerson used those and the juicing mainly, and his migraines went away. So the word kind of spread around his neighborhood in Germany. And other people came to him, and it helped their migraines, but then it started helping people's eczema and their arthritis and all these other, and then one person had tuberculosis. It was killing everybody back then, and it cured that. And then somebody with cancer, their cancer went away. So anyways, he migrated. This was during the war, and he, I think, was being persecuted. I think he was Jewish, probably. So he migrated to New York, and he continued the Gerson therapy protocol, primarily the juicing part of it, and started having multiple case reports of cancer remissions.
Oh my.
And he published a book on 50 cases of 50 patients with their cancer going into remission. Congress called him before the subcommittee, the Senate Foreign Intelligence Subcommittee. I forget what year, I think it's 48 or 49. And he presented the same stuff. He brought 10 patients with him, brought their charts, all the medical tests, the x-rays and stuff. So it's fascinating, the history, but things happened where that was not publicized. Advertisers for the radio station called in and said, "We're not going to advertise with you if you run his interviews,
and you need
to just leave this story alone." And I think the FDA even came after him for practicing medicine with juicing instead of, I don't know. I'll have to go back and refresh my memories. Bottom line, he was persecuted to a degree and had to move to Mexico and start a clinic there. And his granddaughter, Charlotte Gerson, who's probably 95 years old now, or no, his daughter, not his granddaughter, continued his work. She's not a doctor, but she continued his work. You can go to the Gerson Institute in Tijuana. A lot of doctors combo the Gerson diet with ketogenic diet when they're treating cancer patients. But that's the beauty of the integrative world, is they do look at historical stuff like that. What used to help with cancer? What are all the things from chemo to surgery to radiation to juicing to IV vitamin C? You know, the oncologists tell their patients, don't take those vitamins. Vitamin C is an antioxidant. Don't take antioxidants during your chemo. Well, actually, IV vitamin C is a prooxidant, and they don't know that because they don't study vitamin C and they weren't taught. I mean, everyone thinks vitamin C is an antioxidant, and it is orally at low dose. 1 gram, 4 grams, 5 grams, but you get up to 50 grams, 75 grams, 100 grams, it's a prooxidant, meaning it causes an oxidative storm, a hydrogen peroxide release is what happens. Your white blood cells just dump a lot of hydrogen peroxide into the bloodstream when you do high-dose vitamin C, so that's a prooxidant, and prooxidants are very beneficial and for cancer patients has been well established in the literature. So much there. It's an exciting time when you go to these integrative cancer conferences. These guys from around the world are there telling about their stage 4 cancer patients that are alive 20 years later.
We followed Dr. Awesome. Axe pretty closely, and his mom had cancer, and I'm sure you've
Dr. Axe is great. He's all about educating the public, too. Him, Mercola, Pompa.
Yeah.
There's so many good ones. Nasha Winters, I'll kind of promo her show. I think it's the 17th we have her on. And that's all she does now is teach doctors how to use mistletoe as an adjuvant therapy along with your chemo. It potentiates your chemotherapy, makes it work better.
Kissing under the mistletoe.
Just like that, kissing under the mistletoe. So it's a parasitic parasitic plant that grows on trees. And the Germans, for 100 years, the Germans have been studying mistletoe and using mistletoe.
I bet there's essential oil mistletoe.
I'm sure there is. But there's different trees. There's apple, fir, birch, the different trees. And they have it narrowed down to such a science that you get a particular mistletoe from a particular tree for a particular ailment that you're treating, a particular cancer. But they harvest the mistletoe, they extract different things that are in the mistletoe and give it, administer it sub-Q or intravenously, and it causes a tremendous upregulation of different pathways of your immune system, like your natural killer cells. Those are the cells that should be killing cancer. It does a number of things to cause your immune system to recognize and kill the cancer, even the stem cells. So these guys have been using mistletoe for 100 years. Nasha Winters is an expert in it. John Hopkins is doing a study in it now, I believe, based off her work. And again, she's a long-term cancer survivor using these different natural modalities. So unintended consequence, back to that original statement, the Australian researchers are saying, hey, we're using this chemo, but we're only getting a less than 5% survival benefit, so maybe we should look in a different direction. And so we are now looking in a different direction, but I kind of hate that we've spent 50 years. We haven't really touched the cancer survival rates in 50 years, and this is part of it. You're not killing the stem cells. So lots of unintended consequences. I didn't even get to half of them, so maybe we'll have to do that on another show. The Flexner Report, back in the early 1900s, it got our medical education going the wrong direction that has led to the healthcare fiasco we're in now. That's probably something we could talk about in the future.
Okay.
But anyways.
Well, Doctor, we appreciate it once again. Of course, Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, you're the cure. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com, veritasmedical.com. Hey, you have a happy 4th of July. I'll see you back here in a couple of weeks here on the show.
Are we coming next Monday or not?
No, we will not be here next Monday, but the Monday after we will be right here back on the radio with Dr. Edwards. Stick around now. Unconfused coming up next right here on AM 580.